Working Cows Podcast, episode 212.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network, here with another episode for you. And before we get into who's joining me today, I did want to give you a little announcement. If you would head over to the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/212, and there will be a link up there to a survey that the Global Ag Network is doing to get some more information about the people that listen to the podcasts that are part of the Global Ag Network on a weekly basis. This will help inform the advertisers or the people selling advertisements through Meredith. We are now connected to the Successful Farming magazine, and they're taking care of selling all of our advertisements, and they just want to know about who's listening. So if you're willing to do that, that'd be a big help to me. Coming up on 4 years in a couple of weeks, 4 years of doing this podcast, and have had a few advertisements over the years, but really excited about the opportunity to bring in some more revenue and opportunity to partner with some organizations and communicating their stories about their products. And if you'd go over to workingcows.net/212 and click on the link and take the survey, just take you a minute or two to fill in some check boxes there about who you are and how you're involved in agriculture. I'd appreciate it. It'll help shape the ads, hopefully, so that they're more relevant to the people listening. So now on to the show for today. Really excited to be joined today by Roger and Betsy Inderland of Inderland Angus near Big Timber, Montana. And we're going to talk to them today about their soil health journey, how they got introduced to the concepts of soil health and profitable ranching and some of those things. So really excited about that and looking forward to just hearing about their story and how they have changed what they're doing to more take care of the soil. As Burke Tigert said, you know, when I got into ranching, I knew I loved cows, and I realized that I needed to love my grass more than my cows. As I learned more and more, and then ultimately came to recognize that he needed to love his soil first, and then the grass would grow and the cows would be able to harvest that forage. So really excited to talk to Roger and Betsy today of Inderland Angus. Roger, Betsy, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Thank you, Clay.
Been I guess an observer at a distance of your operation for a while, and just appreciated some of the videos that have come out through the Ranching for Profit YouTube channel, and some of the interactions that people that I know personally have had with you guys. So I guess where I'd like to start out with this conversation is just giving you guys an opportunity to share a little bit about the history of your operation there in Big Timber, Montana, how you came to be there, how you came to be connected to that land, and then we'll dive off into a little bit of a discussion about the soil health journey that you all have been on.
Sounds good. I think that's a good one for Betsy to start on.
Well, thanks, Rod. The land we're on right now is Roger's parents' ranch. They moved here in the late 60s, I believe, from the other side of the Crazy Mountains, and then Roger grew up here. I joined the scene in 1986 when we got married. And I'm sure you can fill in a little bit of the in-between there, Raj.
Yeah, just a little bit of background. I mean, we moved here because we're on the other side of Crazy Mountains. It would have been a situation with my older brother and sister getting to high school. Basically, would have been pretty inconvenient to get them to high school. So basically moved here. The school bus came right by the door. That was a real big incentive for my parents because they wanted to live together or otherwise they'd had to live separate basically throughout all of us going to high school. So that was really the primary push as well as an expansion for them. Like this area. And it was still not that far, just across the mountain. But reasons that they relocated. We got here. My mom was, and one of my aunts their family had been in the Angus business historically. My grandfather on my mom's side was one of the founders of the Montana Angus Association. So I took to that and kind of liked the idea of it in high school and bought a small herd of, they had actually let the registration papers on their cattle go. So I don't know, at that point they thought it was too much paperwork, and there was hardly any paperwork at that time. But anyway, that's what they was their excuse, and ran a commercial cow herd. I took an interest in that history a little bit from a fairly early age, and bought a small group of registered cows and pursued that through high school and college. Kind of kept that afloat, just renting grass to my parents. Then when Betsy and I got together and got married, we leased the ranch, and mom and dad retired and sold their cow herd. And from that point on, we operated it. Then we went from there to a lease with an option, and then eventually purchased the ranch. And we've just been kind of at it all along the lines. I was especially lucky in that my dad was extremely conservative, and for inputs, he kind of saw early on that using fertilizers and stuff, those costs that you couldn't control. So I sort of had an advantage with that mindset of, you know, don't get yourself too exposed. But he saw things like the neighbors needing to buy more horsepower to plow the same ground after they'd fertilized it. Those kind of things. So that was, you know, looking back, that was pretty fortunate and pretty natural for me to have some buy-in as to how we landed and how we looked at things.
And can you tell me a little bit about the resource base there? You know, you start talking about South Central Montana. For a lot of the listeners of the Working Cows podcast, you're going to be talking about higher elevations than they're used to, and kind of talk about how that impacts moisture and some of those things on your place.
Yeah, our home place is about 4,500 feet. Really not that terribly high. We're just north of Big Timber, which is on the Yellowstone River. And being 12 miles north, we're also 2 weeks behind them though, because we're climbing an elevation. And then, annual precipitation of about 12 inches, in this area. A lot of our grass is somewhere between 6,500 feet. We lease a lot of ground around the area. So we are kind of dispersed. It's a mixture of, native and introduced on the dry land side. And then there's also a fair amount of flood irrigated ground that comes out of, we store water, and we have two ways of doing that. One is storing water in a lake system and a canal that conveys that out. And another system is water directly out of a creek that, is in a canal system as well. So we are fortunate in having some irrigation available. Our operation is on about 7,000 acres in total, but only a small part of that is deeded land, and the rest is leased. I think there's 15 landlords that we work with, so quite a few smaller landholders and that kind of thing. But cumulatively, it makes an operation that we can at least attempt to scale.
Yeah, so do you guys get a lot of that? Is a lot of the irrigation, is that runoff or is it live water?
It's mostly live water. Yep. On our lakes, we store that water and then use it through the summer. So that's stored water. The other water is live water directly out of the creek. And so that's very subject to the flow given the year. But we're also pretty fortunate. We've had some good pretty consistent. If we're wise with our water, we can do a lot with it. We have irrigated about 600 acres, 600 to 800 is kind of our potential in total. Otherwise it's either introduced dry land, or native dry land.
And is that, all being put up as forage crops, or how are you guys making use of that land?
We've historically grazed, we've been pretty normal, I guess. I should back up a little bit if that's okay, because, as we developed the land after Betsy and I got married and we're leasing it and trying to buy the ranch, you get to a point where we were doing things fairly traditional. Our cattle were fairly traditional, probably not still quite cutting edge or anything, but, we realized that our cost things were getting out of hand. We went to the ranch for profit school. That really kind of changed a lot of things for us. We started realizing that we had tools now to really see we didn't have any more excuses. And in the meantime, we were putting up a fair amount of hay. And fortunately, we actually had a haying enterprise. So that worked fine as long as we had enough acres to do with that. But it was pretty darn busy. But we're pretty traditional cabin, winter calving. And after that, we started changing things fairly rapidly. The people that were the primary customer for the hand business went away, and we transferred to a grazing only system at this point. If we need some high protein hay or something, we purchase that.
Gotcha. And where in the timeline was that ranching for profit school? When did you go?
The first time we went was in 2012, and we joined the EL right away after that, and we're still members of the EL. We have been, and we went the second time in 2018. And I think we're ready to go again, actually.
What were some of the first things you said you started changing things rapidly? What were some of the first things that you guys started to change?
I think our calving date was one of the first, although we had already kind of started to move it back a little bit because we were February, and so we didn't really do what they tell you to do to move it like all at once. We kind of did it 2 weeks at a time over a few years. So don't recommend that, by the way, but that was probably one of the biggest things we changed.
We
started that process of changing.
There certainly was that. The other hurdle we had, we're selling yearling bulls. And so to try to switch too much later, too fast, we didn't know how we'd get by a year basically without income, because we knew we needed to switch to someone coming through the old bulls to match a forage system better. But anyway, so that whole transition, we shuffled that around and got that done over a couple years with the probably 3 to 4 years actually on the calving date and the transition from selling yearling bulls to selling coming 2 year old bulls. So that did take some time and some pain to do that. And the other big thing that started out of that though was we did come home and decide we're going to tie into some what we call cell grazing. We'd read about it. I was curious about it. We had made some attempts at that prior to going to the school, but we never took it seriously and never got good at it. So after the school, we had the, I guess, the motivation to try that more so. And we certainly did. Saw positive effects. So that kind of started that. The next thing that really happened for us probably was a summer conference that Ranch for Profit puts on, was in Laramie in 2013, I think, maybe 14. Anyway, at that, Nicole Masters, who was a soil agroecologist from New Zealand, was speaking. So we got to know her. And then cumulatively, a few people and ourselves decided to bring her over specifically to consult on our ranches. And that really kind of started us understanding, I guess, the systems, and was really kind of an eye opener, and really, I think, showed us the potential. So that's kind of was the springboard for that. And it's just been more and more information all the time.
You know, the more we don't know.
Right. Yep. Definitely. That's every day on the podcast for me. So just keep finding out how deep the rabbit hole goes. So
that's right. Right. Yeah.
Nicole ended up kind of staying in the area, right? Is she still in the Big Timber area?
She is. As a matter of fact, she just texted me and I told her we were on a call with you and she said to say hello.
Oh. Nice.
Right across the highway on a property that we lease is where she's staying.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yep. And go ahead.
Yeah, the way that turned out, she came here in May, I think, of 14. And we met her, had our consultation and everything. And she had sent, you know, recommended reading, and I was fairly diligent about getting that done.
Soil test to do.
Soil test to do. And so we had some pretty good baseline information. And, you know, anyway, but then the real good thing out of that was she headed to Colorado, but there was a snowstorm and she couldn't get there. And so she really didn't have a lot of contacts in the area. So she called us and said, "Hey, I'm kind of stranded. Can I come back?" So we said yes. And she ended up spending a week with us, and we just kind of got to be good friends. And turns out to be quite a blessing.
And so can you kind of walk me through that soil health journey? You mentioned starting out with soil testing. What were some of the initial results, or what did some of those initial soil tests reveal about your land?
It revealed that our soils are very sleepy and constipated, as Nicole puts it, and to do some things to jumpstart the biology. So she did a report and gave us recommendations of some things we could apply that would accelerate the process. She said we could do everything with grazing. It would just take longer. So she recommended some amendments to apply, which was interesting sourcing, you know, different things like, gosh, what were some of them that, you know, to call different companies, fertilizer, soil, health. Well, there weren't really any soil health companies at that time, but just source things, and the people are like, "What are you doing? What do you want this for?" Different chemicals in it. So it was pretty eye opening to realize that this was not a common thing, and it's changed a lot now. There's places supplying the things that are needed, but so that was kind of fun, but. So we did source a lot, and then the application part happened. We had bought a sprayer, and something immediately plugged up the nozzles. So that was a learning curve in itself. We did end up building a sprayer of our own with an old milk tank and a trash pump and a nozzle we got from New Zealand, and we still have that, but. So that was a learning curve that hopefully we can share some of those things with others so they don't have to make the same mistakes we did.
Mm. I mean, we're deficient in boron pretty much across the board. But if you just buy boron, it doesn't go into solution very well. And so it's really hard to get mixed. And you know, some of the discoveries, it started out pretty simple. Kind of turned into a bottleneck and slowed us down considerably. However, we did keep moving along with our grazing, which we kind of started to refine that and improve that. So that and that's our primary tool at this point is our grazing, and amendments are still an important component, but they're not our front and center thing.
Is that because you've applied them and they've kind of kick-started it, and now the cows keep that ball rolling?
It is that. It's a combination of that, and somewhere we haven't got to areas we haven't got to for spraying. I think the grazing is it's been long enough that we're starting to see those positive impacts.
Sure.
Nicole's recommendation was to start on our best ground. And so we did that. We started on some irrigated hay meadows at that time. And we did see improvement. And so we just haven't been able to, you know, get that everything out, especially our dry land that could really, really use the help. We just haven't had time, I guess, or resources to get all that done.
Yep. So she said to start with the spray on your best ground?
Yes. Yep.
And what is the spray? What are you putting into the milk tank and running through the trash pump and the nozzle from New Zealand?
It varies, and it varies somewhat by the soil tests on those fields. But in general, fish oil is a pretty much a standard component. So the fish oil and boron are both pretty standard components. Then we've had some kind of crazy kind of recipes that we've sampled on different things that include, you know, all the way down to milk thistle,
vitamin C.
A whole host of things. And I'm certainly not qualified to say that the specifics of why on each of those things, but the fish oil and the boron is for us pretty broad. That's something that all of our ground can use. So that's reason to do that. The other thing is kelp meal, which is just a real general purpose. We have done some no-till drilling where we use kelp meal and vermicast with the seeding to try to get some stuff established on some really, really, really degraded ground. So we have kind of transitioned, thinking that, you know, the spraying is probably best reserved for the worst ground now. And I think our grazing is doing what it needs to do for the most part on the better ground.
You said really, really degraded ground. Can you describe what you mean by that?
We had some farm ground, small, we don't farm much and never have really farmed much, but we had some dry land hay, crested wheat, alfalfa that we had for years, 40 plus years, if it was good enough to cut, we cut it and made hay out of it. And if it wasn't good enough to cut, we grazed it and season long grazed it. And we reseeded it a couple of times during those 40 years. But it reached a point where we farmed it and we couldn't get anything to take until Nicole said, well, put some kelp meal and some vermicast down the drill with the seed. And then we did get it to strike, as Nicole would say, and so germinate. And that we put in cereal rye and hairy vetch, and that did come on. Didn't do great, but then we did leave that we let that completely be. And then the following year, we had a tremendous sweet clover crop in that field. We let that completely set. But at the bottom of that sweet clover was like a stand of western wheatgrass. So literally like we had seeded it. And that was a thing. And that was really eye-opening. Because we, you know, 40 years of farming and haying, crested wheat and alfalfa, and you kind of do the right, or I guess treat it a little differently and give it time, and it's like we seeded crested wheat. There's still some interspersed alfalfa and stuff that's volunteer. So anyway, as well as green needlegrass, some of our natives are starting to show back up in it. To me, that was really eye-opening, how that could just happen once the conditions kind of got right.
Yeah.
Or better. I use the word right and wrong.
Yeah. Did I hear you right? You said it was like you had seeded western wheatgrass?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, so now it can be a part of our rotation now, and I think we'll maintain it pretty well.
Yep. Well, you described my land, you know, every year for, you know, however long it's been hayed, and you know, if it was grazed because it couldn't make a hay bale, it was grazed for the entire season. So that's my place. So yeah, that's kind of where we're coming from and what we're working with. So I understand that and really excited about, you know, just getting, I guess the thing that we always have to keep in mind, and the more I do this, the more I try to keep it in mind, is that we're not necessarily given a recipe, you know, kind of like you said, not right and wrong, but treating it different, but we're not necessarily given a recipe. We're trying to say, this has worked for us. You know, if you're willing to look outside of the, the agronomic catalog, there are other options that you can try, and they might produce different results.
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah. You know, and the other thing on that ground, we didn't, everybody recommended that we spray it, you know, round up it, make sure we had a kill before we drilled it, because we did do that as a late summer and, you know, hoping for fall germination. And that is what happened, but we did not spray it. We had it grubbed down because it had sat for 2 or 3 years, after several attempts, and we got tired of spending money on it. So we just let it set. In the meantime, it came in cheatgrass and yellow alyssum. I mean, just thick. And so, you know, I was thinking, man, this has gone from bad to worse. But we did. Rubbed it down with cattle and then left a few horses on it the rest of the summer. And it was a drier summer. We seeded into powder, and it was, the horses kept it nubbed down. So that was our attempt at seeing what we could do without chemical, and it did work. There's still some of that, but very minimal.
Yeah. Very minimal. And that was, you said, vermicast and kelp meal that you put in with it, that you sowed, no-till drilled right along with it.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
And of course, as I just got done saying, based on a soil test and the recommendation of a world-renowned agroecologist, so you gotta find, you know, gotta do your homework before you just go out and throw hairy vetch and you know, kelp meal and vermicast in a no-till drill and expect results. But
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. And then be lucky to catch a sweet clover year.
Right.
You know, I mean, yeah. You know, so, you know, because that provided cover that ground had never seen in the past 40 years.
And nitrogen.
Stayed there. And, I mean, that literally was 4 to 5 feet of sweet clover that was, and we left it. We just let it sit there for at least a year, year and a half. And I think that changes the microclimate at the soil surface.
Yeah.
So there's so many things that possibly, but it, you're right, Clay. I think doing the homework a little bit, you know, somewhere along the lines, I'd been to a Gabe Brown, or we were at a Gabe Brown, something that he was speaking at, and I explained our dilemma, and he said, well, you know, if hairy vetch and cereal rye won't take, I don't know what to tell you, basically. So that's where we said, well, okay, that's what we should try. So it is kind of a culmination of, you know, asking questions and then hoping for some luck as well.
Yep.
Our goal was to get a living root in the soil where there really hadn't been much before that. So
yeah, I was trying to figure out a way to put some rye into my place, and one particular source that I had found for a no-till drill that I could rent or borrow said, well, we'd rather not have rye run through that no-till drill, because last time we planted it, it took us 10 years to kill it. And I'm like, well, that sounds like a really good problem to have. But yeah, that's your drill, so I'll let you decide what gets run through it. But yeah, that was, I'm like, well, if I could get something that would grow and keep coming back, that'd be great.
Yeah, no kidding. Therein lies a paradigm shift.
You mentioned a couple of different things, you know, continuing education. What drew you to that, or what pushed you in that direction? Just this desire to continue to learn and to have your paradigms challenged. What was it that kind of put you in a place where you were willing and excited about pursuing those opportunities?
You know, I think initially, before we went to the Ranch for Profit School, as Dave Pratt says, I think it's Dave's thing, you can't see the writing on the wall till your back's against it. Mm. And so I think sometimes you have to be kind of near bottom, literally, sort of, before you'll think about doing changes. Because, you know, if you're making ends meet and everything's fine, there's not as much incentive to change or to look at other options. So initially, I think that was our incentive for going to the school and looking at things differently. And then since then, I don't know, it like opened up a whole new world for us about what's possible and the things that are out there to learn, whether it's, you know, personal improvement or communication with people or just, you know, business practices, those kinds of things. It's just, I just, you know, there's just so much to learn that there's not enough time to learn it all. But it's exciting that the doors that just going to that first school opened for us. And we put it off for 10 years. We said, well, we can't afford to go. We can't afford to do that. And really, we should have done it 10 years before. We had to be down that road. But
yeah,
that's true.
So, I'll use as general numbers as I can because I'm not making anywhere near this amount of money from my podcast. But there was a guy who one time said that delaying the start of his podcast was a six-figure mistake. You know, because every month that he didn't do it was another month he wasn't making that whatever four-figure income for that month. You know, so it's those. When we're delaying it, we're delaying the opportunities that it would open, and we're saying, you know, we're putting them off farther from where we are now and just delaying the opportunities that they will present. So it's, important to weigh that too. What's the opportunity cost of not doing anything?
Right. Yep, I agree.
That is true. And I think the other thing that we were able to kind of get our head around was that there's so much. Once you kind of realize that if you can look at things from a perspective of what can I make or encourage to grow rather than just how do I treat today's problem and know that I might still have to treat that problem next year and the year after and the year after. How can I do things that look towards, you know, kind of longer term solutions? And think about what you're going to encourage to live and do well rather than just the mindset of, well, we're going to kill weeds or we're going to kill pests or, you know, just a kind of a general overall change in philosophically about how you look at each day. That was a big change. And it's made it more fun to get up every day.
Yeah. Our management is inviting certain, you know, entities to our property, whether they be weeds or pests or insects. And if we change our management, we can invite other things. And a lot of times those other things, if we change our management in a positive direction, the things that we invite then become positive things that benefit the whole ecosystem.
Yeah, that's sure. Right. And that's, you know, we don't do anything original. And that's why we go to any event where we can, like Alan Williams talks about, compounding and cascading effects and those kind of things. That's what we want to try to promote and stuff. So part of it is taking the time to observe what's going on and then maybe just getting out of the way is the most helpful thing you can do sometimes.
Well, and asking why.
Right.
Just asking why you're seeing what you're seeing and kind of get to the root of an issue if there is one, or just appreciating what you're seeing.
Yeah, could you talk a little bit about some of the changes on the landscape? I mean, earlier you mentioned the western wheat coming in, which is an incredibly beneficial, I'd say crucial plant probably in your neighborhood as much as it is mine, a crucial grass that is drought tolerant and, you know, very just good at holding on to its nutrient value through stress and into the winter, and good for winter grazing and all those things. So can you talk about some of the other changes that you've seen on your operation?
Well, several things that we've done, or, you know, along the lines, along those same lines, we quit using forons on our cattle. And we followed that up with fecal testing so that we know what our internal parasite load may or may not be. And we have treated two classes of cattle. One was yearling bulls and one was yearling heifers from about 8 years ago when we quit using forons. But the first year after quitting using forons, we saw more dung beetles. The second and third year, we saw a lot more dung beetles. And I mean, by fivefold. And so now we really count on dung beetles. We just consider that they're very valuable and they're doing things. We've also seen considerably more birds. And that was 3 to 4 years after that when we started having the cowbirds following our cattle around a lot more so, pretty prevalently noticeable. Then further than that, we've seen, we didn't have short tail grouse prior to that, to any extent. We now have short tail grouse population.
And fox
and just much more diversity. We can't document that. I just know it's true from living here this long.
Pollinate
a lot more pollinators. Probably one of the bigger things, and it goes to a whole nother level of the, or component of the, one of the systems is the water cycle. But this drought really, really kind of drives that home. But it's not unusual for us anymore to go out in the morning, and if there's dew, that from seed head will just be spider web everywhere. I mean, if you get down and look across it, it literally is just all draped with spider webs that, I don't know if they were formed that night or, you know, but anyway, when there's dew on them, those are all going to sag, and a drop of water is going to come off of that and go to the ground. So I think that combined with the cover and the climate or the microclimate at the base layer, kind of between the soil and organic matter and the canopy, just a lot better habitat for all sorts of bug life that I don't even come close to understanding. But, you know, I think a lot of those spiders are kind of predators. This year we'd have where every 10, 15 feet was a big circle wider spider web that looked like it had a hole in the center of it, but the spider was right in the center of it. And right below that would be 10 grasshopper carcasses. So it just made a believer out of me that all those things, the more of that kind of life we can promote, the better.
Yeah, no, and on a year like this, and I know in central Montana, maybe a little bit farther east than you guys are anyways, the NRCS, even agents from central South Dakota were flying out to help spray grasshoppers. So, I mean, there was kind of a big push just given the fact that there was a drought last year and then again this year, and those grasshoppers moved in and pressured pretty heavily that there was a push on that federal level to try to control some of that. And you guys have, there you go, predator species doing some of that work for you anyways.
That's true. You know, we had grasshoppers, but I don't think it's wrong to spray them and do what you need to do to try to salvage something. I think we were lucky in that we had been doing this long enough. I think some of our plants might have been a little healthier, and grasshoppers don't like a healthy plant. I did notice that on our regrowth, on our irrigated land, I mean, it was pretty nice and green, and there would be some grasshoppers in it, but not bad. But on neighbor's land that had been fertilized and sprayed with Roundup prior to, you know, prior to seeding, and kind of, I would say more the common methods, their regrowth, the grasshoppers were in big time. And I think ours was fine. I'm certainly not saying we didn't have grasshoppers or that it didn't cause us some loss, but I don't think it was, well, I know it wasn't terribly impactful.
Soil testing isn't free. Consultants aren't free. Milk tanks, trash pumps, nozzles from New Zealand aren't free. Have you guys seen the return on investment? Are you, I mean, satisfied with it and would do it all over again and hopefully sooner if you could? But how do you think about those things?
I don't have like a total dollar amount invested at the top of my tongue, and then I could figure it out. But, you know, just gut feeling is yes, it's definitely been worth it, especially when you consider the compounding and cascading effects that are happening that you really can't necessarily link it to one application or one thing specifically. But I guess you just have to, in your mind, know that you're doing the things that are, quote, right, or maybe that's not the right word, but
better.
Improving your land use. Although, I mean, we did do sort of one trial, and we did keep track. I guess we had some land that we, a hay meadow that we had hayed previously, and then we grazed it for 2 years intensively and, you know, rotated for 2 years. And then the year after that, we did cut it for hay, and the production on that was, help me with the numbers, Raj.
Well, it was wore out hay ground. It was only producing a ton an acre, and that's irrigated, and it's 2 ton an acre.
So we were making the decision, like, well, traditionally we would look at farming this up and reseeding it, and we decided, no, we're just going to graze it and see what we can do there for 2 years. And then what did it produce again?
Yeah, 2 ton an acre. Yeah. Over two. It was a little over one and a little over two.
Hmm.
2 years. And the legumes had increased from about 15% up to around 40 to 50% within those 2 years. The alfalfas and clovers. So, that's one case in point. And the other, I think we're very satisfied with the results and exactly wish we would have started 10 years before we did. But, you know, from a big picture perspective, I'm convinced that we are now growing at least 150% of the grass we would have grown historically otherwise. And so, you know, that kind of answers that question that you asked, I think, Clay. I mean, if we could, you know, the only other way to come up with that grass would be to go lease another 4,000 acres, yeah, or try to buy it. I mean, so I think, yes, it pays very, very good that way. And I think I'm being conservative. I mean, I think there's been certainly cases where people talk about, well, you doubled production or by grazing and stuff. And we might have done that here and there, but I'm pretty confident we've accomplished 150% of what we would have been producing before.
Yeah.
That's valuable.
Absolutely.
We did, with Dallas Mountain Health, we did a little video that's on our website that talks about if you could grow 12 grams more of feed. Do you remember the numbers on that, Raj? 12 grams more per square yard.
Yeah, 12 grams more per square yard would equal 240 more pounds per acre.
Which is just like a handful
of dry matter. It's amazing when you boil it down how small an amount 12 grams is. It's like a couple of mouthfuls maybe for a cow on every square yard. But I think that helps to get it into a small thing rather than landscape-wide. It seems like if you can get it down to a small enough thing that you can kind of get your head around. So basically, if we could grow one more plant on every square yard, you know, we would increase our per acre dry matter by 240 pounds, and you do the math on the acres, and we could run another 100 counts. Those kind of things, I like. It's fun to experiment with trying to get it down to something that you can get your head around, I guess.
Yeah. And you mentioned a couple of times the cows and going away from porons and some of those things. You guys have continued the seed stock operation, the registered herd from is it before you guys were married up to this time? Is that right?
Yes.
We've talked a lot about changes in the land. Can you tell me about some of the changes in the cattle that you've seen?
Up until the early 90s, we did try to be use some of the more popular genetics. Tried some carcass kind of bulls and stuff early on. Anyway, long story short, for our low input management system, those cattle were not working. They were just falling out way too fast. And I think primarily couldn't make it through the winter on their, what they could graze on their own. But also just too big and framey and, probably not that efficient at harvesting forage, that they had to bite off themselves. So with that in mind, we started, you know, keeping bulls out of just cows that had really, really done a good job here. And that's where we've kept our herd sires. And to this day, that's what we continue to do for the vast majority of that's what our genetics are. But yeah, I think I also do think that's a, fairly vital component to the soil health part, because you do have to have livestock that you can put through some tests, and that they'll be resilient enough to do that and then still give you adequate performance and keep going on and, you know, get bred and do the things that a cow needs to do, and not have to have help raising their calf. So, yeah, I think it is a vital component. And if they're high input cattle that are calved at the wrong or the not in sync with the nutrition cycle that the grass is providing, all that stuff culminates in making a pretty efficient system. So you can't really eliminate any component. If you do eliminate it and don't consider that, you're decreasing your chances of success, I think. So yeah, we've continued with the seed stock, and we do, we have an annual bull sale. This year it's December 6th, and that's 18-month-old bulls that they're all forage developed. We have enough forage available to carry them bulls through the winter. And also we're going to have a pretty good amount of bred cows for sale this fall. One of our philosophies at this point is going to be to make sure that we don't buy expensive inputs just to carry cattle through the winter. So we do have the forage, but we will make sure that we match that forage to the amount of cows we carry into the winter. And with, you know, because of that, we will get rid of some bred cows. Depending on our breed up. I mean, you know, we might be a little surprised or something, but next week after we've done our break jacking and stuff, we'll be able to do those calculations and compare that to our forage inventory. And we do have a reserve hay pile. I don't recommend thinking that you can get through with no hay or no, we divide that into what we call substitute feed, is basically energy that you have to carry them. Supplement feed is like a little bit of high protein alfalfa or some cake or protein tubs or something like that. And we don't mind purchasing a little bit of substitute feed, but I don't want to be buying expensive substitute feed.
And so will there be an updated listing of the females that would be available by like the October 25th? Or do you know when you might?
It'll be shortly after that. Okay. Our last pregnancy date that we have calendared is the 26th of October, I think. And by the end of that week, we should have a pretty good idea of where we're at on that. And we also have been keeping most all of our heifer calves, carrying them through and exposing those. with that in mind, we've kind of been on a growth pattern. We're going to, this drought, this drier weather, we didn't grow as much feed as we normally would. We can't always keep them all.
Very good. Well, yeah, so coming up December 6th, 2021, you can get more information at IndralandRanch.com. It'll be linked in the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/212, workingcows.net/212. You can go there and find a link to the Inderland Angus website, and you can, in the near future, very near future, you'll be able to see some of those females and the bulls that they'll have on offer there December 6th.
That's right. Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, one of the things we do is there's not a lot of, we don't really use a lot of performance information or anything like that. Our cattle are high dollar energy, but one of the things we do in an effort to sort out even our sires we multi-sire breed. So then we take DNA on all the calves and then identify the sires that way. We've got a bull now that has done like 60 calves, 70 calves, 73 calves, another 70 this year, natural service in a competitive breeding environment. Those are the kind of bulls that we really, really want daughters out of. So I think that just that desire to propagate themselves is something that we're able to select for and through our system.
Yeah, I went to Steve Campbell's class, and he said, you know, 50 years ago when you drove into the rancher's driveway, you leaned over to the wife and said, don't ask him how many cows he has, just count the bulls and times by 50. Well, now we're down to count the bulls and times by 25. So, I think that those bulls that do go out and go to work are a valuable asset to have on a commercial operation.
I think that's really right, Clay. I think another thing that's come into play along the soil health and the way ranches have evolved as cows have gotten bigger, there's just more pounds. If you're a 400 cow ranch, you've been thought of as a 400 cow ranch for a long time. In the meantime, the cows went from 11 to 1400 pounds. So that's a 30% increase in forage demand. And I guess we've accomplished that and bridged that with fertilizers and, round balers. But there's certainly a cost side to that. And now that same land base is expected to produce, 30% more forage. I'm not sure that's fair. I think that's the other thing about there's kind of a paradigm thing is what is fair when you ask what your land should do? You got to give it a fighting chance.
We need to think in terms of pounds per acre, not pounds per animal.
Right.
Very, very good. I think that's a great place to wrap it up, unless you guys got some other big nuggets that you wanted to mine yet.
I don't know. We could go on for a couple hours. It's fun to talk about, but no, we're good. I think we've hit the high points. I think you asked good questions and was able to, hopefully we were able to make that understandable.
I think you guys both did a great job.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, but it's almost infectious, this stuff, that, which is, it's kind of great from that perspective, because just about everybody you talk to that's doing this kind of stuff is excited, and they're excited about opportunities and learning, and versus there's a whole nother side that's just struggling. And I think that struggle is real, and I think there's an emotional toll that's being paid.
I think that struggle is connected to what you talked about with the increase in cow size and trying to eke out more productivity from the same number of acres. I think a lot of that struggle is you look at the graph that Steve Kenyon shows all the time of the increased profits for the ag business sector. And we'll leave aside for now the fact that agricultural operators do not fall into the ag business sector and the problems that presents when they're not thinking of themselves as business owners, but that ag business sector profits have skyrocketed, and the agriculturalist you know, boots on the ground individual, his profits have waned and even dropped below break even for many years. And I think that's a lot of that is just connected to this more mentality rather than trying to figure out how to match what God provides to what we're trying to accomplish.
I think that's exactly right. So I think, and that's where, to me, that, you know, you just got to ask what's fair. How much can I really ask for? A real key component. You know, we did a little talk in Miles City the other day, Betsy and I did, and it was so health-based. Kind of tried to, just from a big picture perspective, apply numbers. And we posed the question at the beginning of our talk was, what if you just got rid of every animal on your property and let it set for a little over a year? My guess is, and at least from our experience, is that you would have 150% of the feed you normally produce still available, short of a fire or something like that, after that year of rest. And my point was, is that if you, and a lot of ranches might have about a $500,000 operating expenses for a year, but if you got rid of your livestock, let's say you could cut that to $250,000. If you were a 10,000 acre ranch, in essence, you bought another 5,000 acres for $250,000 by weight. And so I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there's any merit to that or not, but it certainly kind of makes a point.
Yeah, definitely. Very good.
But we certainly don't know that we have all the answers or claim to. It's certainly a, you know, one thing we've done, which has been pretty humbling. We did hire an advisory board because we realized the value of other people's opinions that weren't stuck in our rut. So we've hired Nicole Masters is on our advisory board, and Burke Teichert, our local veterinarian, and we had Dallas Mount, and now we have Dave Pratt. But just the value of having that other set of eyes looking at what we're doing is just invaluable and challenging us. And we need to kick, you know, we need to kick in the pants and the accountability. But it makes it more like a business when you're accountable to other people.
Yeah, really, really helpful. Very, very good. I appreciate that. Betsy, anything else?
You know, I just really think this soil health journey that we're on and continue to be on is really the bright spot for the future of ranches like ours and for young people wanting to come back to the ranches and for opportunities for other young people to get involved as well. I would just love to see our landscape repopulated with a lot of young families, and I just think of the compounding and cascading effects of all that, you know, as our community, you know, continue to get smaller, at least with agriculturally based families. So I just love to see more people come back to the land and, you know more about the food they eat.
Yeah, very good. No, I appreciate that very much. I'm with you. I think just the difference in conventions. You walk into one convention and it's kind of ho-hum, woe is me. You walk into another convention and it's, I think the word Dallas Mount used one time was vibrating. it's alive. There's hope and excitement and just really, really, really appreciate it.
No, that difference is pretty palpable.
Yeah. Infectious too.
And so. It is infectious, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Whether you think you can or think you can't, you're right.
Yeah.
Henry Ford say that.
I
can't remember who said it, but somebody other than
yeah. You tell me it all the time.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's just good what you guys have shared here today. You know, and a big part of it is just being willing to look somewhere other than the magazines that sell you the next input, you know, and finding outside the box opportunities.
Yeah, and what a job you've done, Clay, of helping to spread that. I mean, I'm sure that wasn't easy, and I'm sure it doesn't continue to be easy because it takes time and effort, and what an asset and good thing you're doing in helping spread the good word in a lot of ways. you know, beyond being a pastor. So that is phenomenal.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. And well, I appreciate you guys, Roger and Betsy. Thank you for your time today.
You bet. You're welcome. Take care. You. If you're ever in this area, get a chance to swing in. It doesn't matter if it's evening or whatever. We got extra room. So by all means, our door is wide open. So
I've got family north of White Sulphur Springs, so I hope to make it up there sometime. So.
Okay. That sounds good. We'll show you our worm farm.
Good stuff there with them. Really appreciate them taking the time to share their story. And we're really excited to continue talking to folks and continue sharing with you paradigm challenging content. I know that recent episodes have challenged more than a few paradigms, and I've heard back about it. And I'm always willing to talk to somebody who has an alternate point of view. I'm not necessarily here to share the end all be all truth. I'm just here to expose ideas and give people things to think about as they continue to manage their operations. So if you were wanting to push back, I welcome that. And if you got somebody in mind that would offer an alternative perspective to anything that we've talked about in the 212 episodes, I'd be happy to feature them. So I look forward to releasing another episode of the Working Cows podcast coming your way real soon.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.